Of you out so bright and early this morning, welcome to session number 312 of the 2000 Sunstone Symposium. This is Dancing with the Sacred by Phyllis Barber. I've known Phyllis for a long time. I used to work for her ex-husband for a few years in a seminar company. She is a very lovely and talented lady. She's the author of 6 books, including the novel And the Desert Shall Blossom, the prize-winning How I Got Cultured, a Nevada memoir, and this is available at the Sunstone Books, and Parting the Veil, Stories from a Mormon Imagination, also available there. I just bought these this morning. She has taught in the Vermont College MFA program in writing, where she won the Excellence in Teaching Award. And she also taught at the University of Missouri at Columbia as a visiting writer. Currently, she has a novel in progress entitled Bicycle Blues. She is the mother of 3 sons, Chris, Jeremy, and Brad, and lives in Park City, Utah. And she's also planning to be married next month. So without further ado, we will hear from Phyllis Barber. We don't have a respondent to this paper, so when she is done, we will open it up to questions from you. Phyllis?
This morning. These are my reading glasses. So well, I hope I can read without them. Thank you very much for being here. It's a great pleasure to see you, and I hope this will be a worthwhile hour for you. Or it won't be an hour, really, not quite. The title of my paper is Dancing with the Sacred. Shall we dance? Or should I say, may I have this dance? But first I'd like to recite a poem for you, a poem by Hafiz, a Sufi poet born in the 1300s in Shiraz in southern Persia. I have 1,000 brilliant lies for the question, how are you? I have 1,000 brilliant lies for the question, what is God? If you think that the truth can be known from words, if you think that the sun and the ocean can pass through that tiny opening called the mouth, oh, someone should start laughing. Someone should start wildly laughing now. Even though I attended the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints regularly for 40 years, almost never missing a Sunday and serving in administrative, teaching, and music capacity since the age of 7, and even though I've borne my testimony countless numbers of times and attended seminary and Brigham Young University, I confess I now speak in a voice which is not purely Mormon, whatever a pure Mormon sounds like. Possibly my voice erupted by my love of dancing with everything, people, ideas, sunshine, and sacred cows. Or maybe it has to do with being human. Maybe insatiable curiosity has been the corrupting agent, or maybe it's a fact of loving to read any and everything. Or could it be a fatal attraction to mysticism, or a fascination with Taoism, Buddhism, Judaism, Sufism, and the beliefs and practices of native peoples? And then there's my love affair with Rumi, Hafiz, and Kabir, 12th century Persian poets influenced by Sufism, the inner heart of Islam, and always informed by an ecstatic relationship with God. These poets speak of being so much in love with God that all they can do is forever dance. The ecstasy of their writing speaks across the centuries and fills me with incredible joy. And I felt this same joy standing with the congregation and joining in with gospel music and the hallelujahs in the African Methodist Episcopal Church in Denver, Colorado, or at the Second Baptist Church in Columbia, Missouri. I can feel God dancing everywhere, all around me. He's not somber or pale or aloof. He moves with the music that's always playing. He shimmers. Therefore, rather than speaking with an untainted, well-modulated Mormon voice, I speak as an ecstatic woman who loves dancing, who loves abandoning the punitive shoulds and engaging with the boundless beauty of God. It courses through my veins, this mainline beauty of God, direct to the heart. Just as there's a difference between knowing the definitions of health and having a healthy body, there's a huge difference between knowing what is sacred and holy and experiencing the divine spark of God that can fill each of our beings if we allow it. This past April, I flew into Mirazal, Ecuador, which is located in the rainforest of the Oriente, or better known as the Amazon Basin. We flew in a single-engine plane past clouds of gray volcanic material spewing from the center of the earth into a sky filled with white, insubstantive clouds. After landing at a military airstrip because of torrential rain at our original destination, we landed on a small grassy runway, our plane spattered heavily with mud. This was our first acquaintance with the home of the Shuar tribe, a head-hunting tribe until 30 years ago. My six-week journey to Peru, Bolivia, and Ecuador was undertaken for the purpose of meeting with shamans from the indigenous tribes of the Andes as well as the jungle, to participate with them during their healings, to be taught by their 5,000-year-old ancient wisdom. Not only are these people knowledgeable about plant wisdom that can help save lives, they also have a knowledge of how to retrieve the lost spirit or fragmented self in ways not practiced or known by contemporary technicians of Western medicine. One night in the jungle, some members of the tribe came to our lodge, which was a lodge only in the sense of having rooms in which to sleep, not commercial in any way, and used only for the occasional visitors allowed into Mirazal. They came to demonstrate the old ways of the Shuar people. Dressed in wraparound cloth rather than the bare-breasted jungle wear we've all seen in National Geographic, they showed some of the tribal customs, how they used to visit their friends' homes, how they greeted each other with spears and complex choreography and chanting, how they entertained each other with a brew called chicha, made by the Shuar women from manioc root and saliva, which they spit into the mixture and allowed to ferment. Chicha was carried with them whenever they went for a visit, and they expected us to enjoy this, served in a half coconut shell with them. After this demonstration, some musicians began to play music from the Andes, and some of the Shuar came over to ask some of us to dance. One caution we'd received was that we weren't to look into the eyes of the opposite sex, as this meant an invitation to passion in the jungle. So, when an older gentleman came to me and asked me to dance, I followed him and concentrated on his feet. When he asked me later to dance again, I was getting bored of counting toes, so I thought maybe we could clap hands together or something like that. I tried to get him to clap right hands, and at first he was confounded by this business. But after a few of my own demonstrations, he finally clapped my hand, both of us laughing like children, and then the music ended. The leader of our group came to me after the dance was over and said, with a slightly amused expression on her face, "Did you know who you were dancing with?" "No," I said. "Tonk is one of the most powerful shaman in the Shuar tribe." "Oh," I said, unable to think of another response, suddenly pulled into a strange vacuum where I wondered if I had offended in some way. Only in recent years have these South American shaman consented to interface with North Americans. According to the leader of our group, the shamans feel that the land of the eagle, North America, where the eagle is a bird of prey, and the land of the condor, South America, where the condor only eats carrion, have much to teach each other. In the last 10 years, they've had visions where they were told it was time to break the silence and allow an interchange with foreigners. The condor and the eagle have much to teach. Before that time, they were unwilling to share their ancient knowledge with those outside their tribe. Admittedly, I went to South America with a great respect bordering on reverence for the shaman's primitive connection to the divine and for their willingness to share their wisdom. If I'd known who Tonk was before the dance, I would have worried about protocol. I may have done something false or possibly unnatural, like kowtowing, to pay my culturally expected respects. Truth of the matter, I would have missed an amazing connection with another human being had I known his title or position. I would have let my thoughts, my notions, my expectations of what a shaman is to interfere. The next day, talking with Tonk through a translator, I told the translator to tell him that he was a good dancer. The translator laughed and said, "He was just telling me what a good dancer you were." I looked at Tonk, maybe at Tonk's chin, rather than his eyes, and he smiled back at me. The habit of being respectful is a valuable habit. It is good and fine to have respect for each other, sensitivity, caring, respect for leaders, elders, traditions. But when do we cross that dangerous line of putting something on a pedestal and making it into a statue that cannot smile, bend, or stretch? Do we truly respect something or someone if we put them on a pedestal or put them above us or in a greater position? Is that false, a pretense, something we think we should do? When do sacred words become stones on the lips because they've been repeated so many times that they've lost their essence? Do we think about the words and familiar phrases we speak? Do we have our own connection to this customary language, or have we borrowed it for comfort's sake? How do we keep ourselves from habituating our response to the sacred? How can the sacred remain fresh, a new spring from which to draw, full of endless possibilities rather than circumscribed and fenced in? Let us not narrow ourselves up, Brigham Young warned, for the world with all its variety of useful information and its rich hoard of hidden treasure is before us. When I arrived in Cusco, Peru, a month before my time in Ecuador, I had just finished my menstrual cycle. I was happy to have it behind me. But every day for the 6 following days, I bled heavily, unusually heavily. At first, I thought it was the change in altitude or problems with menopause, so I disregarded it. But each day the bleeding was heavier, and on the 3rd day, bordering near hemorrhaging, I consulted one of the doctors who was traveling with us. He said it wasn't unusual with a change of altitude, so once again I disregarded this abnormal reaction of my body. We were traveling with a Peruvian shaman named Teo Paredes, and on the 6th morning, on the day we left for Machu Picchu, I said something to him as well. He said it was not unusual for women to bleed when they made such drastic changes in locality and altitude. But by the time we got on the train for Machu Picchu, I was forgetting my luggage, my purse, and my traveling companions were picking up after me. By the time we reached the Machu Picchu Pueblo Hotel, I was totally disoriented. I don't remember how I got to my room, but when I got there, I told my roommate she'd better send for the doctor. I was in trouble. Luckily, Teo's sister, Dr. Milagros Paredes, was a gynecologist in Cusco. Their father had started a medical clinic in Cusco in the 1940s and had decided to raise one child in the tradition of Western medicine and his other child in the shamanic tradition. Teo, who was Castilian rather than one of the indigenous people, was trained in the way of the shaman from the age of 11. After he and the North American doctor traveling with us consulted Teo's sister Milagros by telephone, they were instructed to administer a shot to stop the bleeding. But the loss of blood had left me in a very dark place. My brain seemed a window of blank white surrounded by a stark black frame. Teo decided to give me a healing. After using feathers, agua de Florida, which he sprayed on me from his mouth, and traditional shamanic healing implements, Teo asked me to give him my full name. After I gave it to him, he anointed my head, I'm not sure with what, and then laid his hands on my head and blessed me. Phyllis Nelson Barber, he said, then spoke in a different language, one I'd never heard from my father or other priesthood holders over the span of my life. But nonetheless, the words felt familiar. I felt connected to thousands of years of spirit being transmitted from the source to my ailing body. My temporal father was with us that day, and the divine father, and an added element, Pachamama, Mother Earth, whom Teo invoked that day and whom he says is our real mother, the one who cares for us above all other mothers and fathers. I loved that Pachamama had been included. Triply blessed. By the next morning, my strength returned. So how does one dance with a sacred? Maybe by looking for the sacred in unexpected places. Maybe God isn't always found in special buildings. Maybe God's not always dressed for church or found through preordained channels. But how can the divine presence possibly appear to us when we are so blindly fumbling along, not watching for movement in our peripheral vision because of our attachment to notions of who God is and what God looks like? One day, many years ago, after my young children had gone off to school, I felt an overflowing feeling of spirit in my entire body, and then an impulsive thought came to me. Today, I'm going to dance with God. I turned on some piano music that has always moved me to the bone, the Prokofiev First Piano Concerto, and closed my eyes, let the music soak into me, and proceeded to dance in my family room as if I were dancing with God. I held out my arms as if I had a partner. I felt divine arms wrap around my shoulders. We whirled in an ecstatic trance, and I felt transported to a feeling of oneness where God and I were each other. I felt moved in a very rare way. I'd called God in for a dance, and the divine presence had come. Am I speaking of mysticism here? Mysticism being the experience of direct communion with ultimate reality, a spiritual union. But maybe the term mysticism is an uncomfortable one in today's Mormondom, this direct and intuitive acquisition of ineffable knowledge or power. Joseph Smith definitely qualifies as a mystic, but is there a place for mysticism in the practical reality of today's Mormonism? I've read accounts of Catholic and Jewish mystics, watched penitentes in purple robes and tall point hats, in processions of thousands carrying crosses on their backs to ask forgiveness of Christ. And I've wondered about my ability to keep from erecting a wall between myself and the divine because of my Mormon perception of what is true, what is false, and what is sacred. How many sacred cows stand in my line of vision when I'm trying to see God? The Buddhists say in their enigmatic way, if you see the Buddha in the road, kill him. Another contemporary saying in some spiritual circles is, don't mistake the messenger for the message. From Volume 5 of the History of the Church, Joseph Smith says, he was defending an old man who had been brought up for excommunication. I do not like the old man being called up for erring in doctrine. It looks to me like the Methodists and not like the Latter-day Saints. Methodists have creeds which a man must believe or be asked out of their church. I want the liberty of thinking and believing as I please. It feels so good not to be trammeled. How can we understand something if we can't play with it or dance with it or ask it questions or turn it around in our hands? To be mystical is to experience a spiritual reality that is neither apparent to the senses nor obvious to the intelligence. It is being open to the surprise of God, the communion with ultimate reality. William James, in his masterpiece, The Varieties of Religious Experience, says, mystical states are more like states of feeling than like states of intellect. No one can make clear to another who has never had a certain feeling in what the quality of worth of it consists. One must have musical ears to know the value of a symphony. One must have been in love oneself to understand a lover's state of mind. Lacking the heart or the ear, we cannot interpret the musician or the lover justly, and are even likely to consider him weak-minded or absurd. The mystic finds that most of us accord to his experience an equally incompetent treatment. An anonymous reviewer of my latest book, Parting the Veil, Stories from a Mormon Imagination, reviewing for a Northern California newsletter called The Latter-day Messenger, made an interesting comment. Quote, this is not a book I would want of any of my friends to read. I would not want anyone, Mormon or non-Mormon, thinking that this is how Mormons really think and act. Most of these stories seem to deal with obsessions, sometimes sexual, sometimes on physical objects, and sometimes on spiritual visitations and messengers, although they are not usually the kind of messengers we hear about in the scriptures. This is not a book I will be keeping in my library. This made me laugh. It made me wince, and it also made me ask questions of myself and the book. Had I moved so far away from Mormonism that I didn't understand it anymore? Is a Mormon supposed to think and act in an always predictable manner? Hadn't I written the stories out of my deep love for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and some of its ironies? Had I been too playful with sacred things and sacred ideas? Had I been disrespectful? I hadn't intended to either misrepresent or represent Mormonism, but rather to play with some of the theology, even dance with it. But what about this dancing with the gospel and this asking questions of the givens? What are the givens? Can a writer or a painter or a sculptor play with Mormon notions? Can she approach scriptures as a diadem with many facets? Can she hope to find a greater illumination? Dancing, playing, approaching the old stories with new eyes, new questions, new possibilities. Why not? Like, what happens, as it did in one of my stories entitled Dust to Dust, when a rich rather than a poor person knocks at the door and asks for someone's last dime? How elegant we are in responding to the poor. how self-sacrificing and noble we can be, but aren't the rich sometimes in need? God lives in the souls of all people, rich or poor. Or what happens, as it did in another of my stories, Devil Horse, when a man's horse is spooked by the devil? Isn't it conceivable that a man might want to protect this horse, even baptize him? Or is it irreverent to think of baptizing an animal? I recall rumblings from the pulpit that animals have souls too. Dancing with the words, dancing with ideas. How can we possibly know God if we aren't open to what God and the possibilities of God are? Another way to say this is that if you are my husband or wife and I know exactly who you are and how you will respond in every situation, then I leave no room for other options, no room for growth or change. That's a good way to kill a person while they're alive, not thinking they're large enough to surprise us. Is it sacrilegious, irreverent, or of bad report to dance with established notions? How established must they remain? How attached are we to having answers where all the T's are crossed and I's dotted, where we can be absolutely sure? How much does one miss when one knows everything beforehand? How does one remain open for inspiration with so many fences around the answers? Can the sky be the limit, or do we need to keep everything in hedgerows, tidy and neat? Brigham Young again. Let us not narrow ourselves up. Once again to the consideration of mysticism with another quote from Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. A genuine first-hand religious experience is bound to be a heterodoxy to its witnesses, the prophet appearing as a lonely madman. If his doctrine proved contagious enough to spread to any others, it becomes a definite and labeled heresy. But if it then still proved contagious enough to triumph over persecution, it becomes itself an orthodoxy. And when a religion has become an orthodoxy, its day of inwardness is over. The spring is dry. The faithful live at second hand exclusively and stone the prophets in their turn. The new church, in spite of whatever goodness it may foster, can be henceforth counted on as a staunch ally in every attempt to stifle the spontaneous religious spirit and to stop all later bubblings of the fountain from which, in purer days, it drew its own supply of inspiration. I've often killed so much of what I wish I could express because it doesn't measure up to some standard, because it lacks the perfection I so strive for. But couldn't that be considered sheer arrogance to think I can't put something on paper unless it is perfection or praiseworthy or magnificent? I am a humble scribe as well as a beautician of words. Curl them, cut them, snip them, tighten them to perfection. But who decides what is perfect? Is my notion of perfection so far above possible standards that I've paralyzed the life, the creativity inside me? Perfection by the dropper full, a little bit of poison, a little bit at a time. Does my notion of perfection cut me off from God? Somehow it's like this. There's an ancient Chinese discipline of meditative movement known as Tai Chi. A student of Tai Chi might watch a form demonstrated by the teacher 1,000 times. The student might think he or she knows what the teacher is doing. But one day, after seeing this movement 1,000 times, the student gets it that she's never really seen the movement for what it is. She's observed the exterior movement, but never seen the interior move, the way the instructor moves an arm from the center of her being, not by moving or waving an arm by itself. A year before I went to Peru and Ecuador, I suffered a serious breakage of my heart, a shattering into pieces so small it seemed I'd never find it again. Over the year, I'd paid much attention to healing myself physically, emotionally, and mentally, but I still carried the vestiges of sadness with me like dried glue on paper. When I first met Alberto Toxo, a shaman near Otavalo, Ecuador, his retreat nestled in the valley surrounded by Imbabura, Mohanda, and Cotacachi, I saw a man gifted with the light of Christ. Light radiated from his face as well as his entire being. I decided this was a man who could be trusted and decided to allow myself to have a healing from him. As I waited for my turn in the round adobe room with an open fire in the middle of a hard earth floor, I asked in prayer to have my sadness, depression, embarrassment, and shame removed from me. As I prayed, I symbolically threw these things on the fire where they could be altered, transformed, and purified into something new. I'd spent enough time with those painful teachers. As my turn came to stand in front of Alberto, he didn't look into my eyes or even directly at me, but rather at the whole of me and the extension of me, the energy around my body. We exchanged no words. I didn't ask for what I hoped to receive. Using large condor feathers, hawk feathers, carefully chosen herbs and incense, he began a very ritualized healing, as he had done with the others, circling me and humming quietly as he did. Then he set the large feathers aside and returned to stand in front of me holding a handful of baby feathers. As he worked in an extraordinarily gentle way around the parameters of my heart space, the tears began to flow from me, and I surrendered to a total state of feeling. No questions, no analysis, no comparisons of this or that. My feelings have always frightened me because they run so deeply and feel so dangerously vulnerable. But I stood there, openly in front of Alberto and several members of our group, and wept. He blew on my heart space slowly with his breath and then tossed the baby feathers into the fire. The divine, God, the other, the magnificent, all of that was there, burning in the fire, rising up out of Alberto Toxo, encircling my body and bearing witness to my belief that God is in everything everywhere, and that if one keeps one's eyes open, one can see God with arms outstretched, calling to us, asking us to put our cares and ultimatums aside and join in the dance. A final poem from the Persian poet again, Hafiz. Start seeing everything as God, but keep it a secret. Become like a man who is awestruck and nourished, listening to a golden nightingale sing in a beautiful foreign language while God invisibly nests upon its tongue. Who can tell you in this world that when a dog runs up to you, wagging its ecstatic tail, you lean down and whisper in its ear, "Beloved, I'm so glad you're happy to see me. Beloved, I'm so glad, so very glad you have come." Thank you.
Okay, we are now open for questions. Ask your question and I'll repeat it into the microphone so we have it on the tape. There's nothing more frustrating than buying a tape of a session and you hear the answers and not the questions. So I will repeat those into the microphone. So who has a question for Phyllis? Now surely somebody has a question. Yes.
This is too broad a question to be answered, but how did you get to there, Phyllis?
Did you get to there?
All yearn for a seeking for and a willingness to believe in the sacred. How did you get to this?
Okay, the question was, how did Phyllis get to this point where she is now?
Well, I think getting to ground zero helps. No, I think getting to a place where you're helpless and you hurt so much or something like that, that you ask for help instead of knowing what you need for help. And so I think when I reached that point, I've had a rough 7 years then. So when I reached that point and literally said I really need some help, I feel like that I opened up to allowing a lot more to operate in my life, to be with me. That's
vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And not... I remember when I was younger and a mother and thinking I knew a lot of things, I sort of strode around with a lot of surety and cockiness. And I don't have that anymore.
I think I'm going to pass the mic as best I can.
In your resume, you raise the possibility that our considering in advance that something is sacred puts a barrier and deprives us of, and them also, of inner relationships. And I wondered, as our church leaders have become remote and separated from us, I look back over my own life, and of course, long enough that I've been close to 5 leaders and watch them and personally, and I've always maintained that we seduce them into the sin of pride by our adulation, by our bowing to them, by putting them on the stand, mm-hmm. by calling attention to them, and mm-hmm. all this kind of thing, and that they have to. I was intrigued when President Hinckley said lately, adulation is poison. And I wondered, too, if the intimacy of the television, I mean, it was like almost standing 3 feet from him, would overcome this actual physical barrier that we have had to have between us and our leaders. Would you give some opinions on it? And
I have a first cousin who's in the first quarter of the 70s, so I always just tease him all the time. You know, I mean, I really honor his position and everything, but he's still my cousin that used to run foot races with me. I really do think, as you said, adulation is a poison. I think we create it as much as the person who's being worshipped. So I think it's a two-way street, and I think we rob somebody. You know, I guess in the feminist movement a while back, women were saying, don't put me on a pedestal. And it's sort of, I don't like it when somebody looks up to me too much, because it's like I know how flawed I am as a human being. And it's like I like to meet people on common ground. So, and this is not to say we have to think our leaders are flawed, but they are human after all. And so I think that we respect them more, treating them as part of us. Because we're all God. It's my opinion. So.
You said you were a fairly orthodox Mormon until you were about 40. What caused you to change?
Ooh. Do I want to answer this question? I married a man who was a returned missionary, and I thought I was getting the whole deal. You know, and after we got married, he started not wanting to go to church anymore. In fact, didn't like it at all. And so we had a lot of years of back and forth struggle about that. And I finally, I'd say after 20 years, just said, this is hurting our family incredibly, because there was just a lot of bad feeling about every time I'd drag people, the kids off to church. And we weren't living a very Christ-like life in our family. So I chose to see if I could save our family first. So.
Phyllis is a closet mystic. I'm really delighted to meet another mystic that's more open. In my case, my experience began with the death of my 19-year-old son. It was a suicide, and I had a difficult time reconciling my feelings with the perception of what other people should be feeling, because I had a mystical experience that said he was fine. And if he was fine, I was fine. But reconciling that was difficult. And I began studying with an African shaman who gave me a lot of support and understanding that I did not get from people in my ward, and I consider myself active. And this began crisis as well as support and opportunity, because my main emotional support was not coming from my ward members. The only answer to how are you is fine. I mean, if you're seeing someone in the hall during class changes, you don't tell them, I'm losing it. Is there, in your view, a problem with a society that talks about the one true church and the only right answers, and all of this should come from this source, and a world where information and ideas and answers are so prevalent beyond our own limited view that we often get feeling guilty about looking into other possibilities? I'm a real practical person. Whatever helps works, or whatever works helps, and that's where you should look. But there are many, many different religions and philosophies that lift, support, build, and heal people. And I think our focus as a church implies that we have all the answers. Do you want to respond to that?
I have trouble with that. I must say that this is the only church, the only way. And I think it also keeps the Mormon church together. So that creates a paradox. But I feel like if I am open to what's available and still respecting the people around me in my ward, I mean, I always felt in the ward I could learn from everybody in the ward. And so I always went with that attitude. And I'm not quite answering your question. Kind of drew a blank here. I had some answers while you were talking. But I mean, just my particular spirit doesn't like the idea that there's only one answer. So, because I'm always curious and I always want to find out something else. But I think it's not impossible to be a member of the church and still be open to a lot of ideas. And I was speaking with Chaco Okazaki, and she said to me, she said, we really need people in the church like you, Phyllis, because you're questioning and you're not bitter about the church. You love it and you care and you're asking questions, and that's, we need to be there. And so the tendency is to say, I'm going to get out, I have to leave to live my life. I don't think that's true. I think that you have to gently walk, and I mean, I'm not active now because it's been so many years, and it's been very painful. Believe me, it wasn't an easy decision. I didn't walk away, dancing and saying, oh, you know, I know what's better. I love Mormonism. It's my home.
Yeah. Would you come up to the microphone, please, ma'am?
Am I still more? I haven't been excommunicated, if that's the question. I'm sorry, what? Oh, do I believe in a mother God? I think that he is a convenient pronoun that we've used, and I think God is really an encompassing all things, male and female. But we do use the pronoun he. And you could get into South American religions and Pachamama and Mother Earth and all those things. I don't know that I believe in a Mother God specifically, because that would exclude a Father God. So I believe in a God that encompasses all of those things.
Thank you. I would just like to say I'm not sure there's a place for people to go to church and feel the way you do. And so is this Sunstone meeting the only place where we can find the longing for the sacred? Do we have to do it on our own? Do we have to dance with God in our own rooms? Or is there another place? I'm saying, where do you go? Where do I go? Where do a lot of...
I like to go to gospel churches, gospel singing churches sometimes. And I think you could still be involved with Mormonism and do this, but I like the ecstatic way they sing, and when they go down, it's like, I wish Gladys Knight would have her way. But maybe, things will open up, new kinds of hymns, but where you really need to go is with yourself. And I remember when my life and marriage was falling apart, I kept thinking the church was going to save me. You know, it's kind of like, well, it's not working here, so I'm going to go to the church. That's where I'm going to go. And I realized there wasn't a church there to catch me in its net. So I had to catch myself. I think that's the place.
When you said you changed in order to help to save your family,
mm-hmm.
Well, did you save them from Mormonism or...
I saved them from a great deal of chaos in our family itself. And
did the church play a role in that?
No. Because there was such divisiveness over whether we should attend church or not, that it created a lot of problems.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Sir?
I was wondering about what the response has been to your word community or your family towards your explorations in Sufism and the South American that I just was wondering, because there's a Sufi traveling saint in Salt Lake who my grandmother and our family went to a zikr, and she had a blessing. And when she told her sister about that, her sister was just aghast and told her she had to immediately go and repent and mm-hmm. go to her bishop and that. And my grandma was a little bit dismayed about that response. And so I was wondering what your experiences have been like that.
Well, when I finally decided to not go to church anymore, before I had been back and forth, like, should I or shouldn't I? So when we're feeling kind of back and forth, people can play on you a lot easier. When you decide, this is what I'm going to do, it's very funny. People respect that. And so I think if you want to go dance with the Sufis, and if you feel good about it, that's the key. I mean, you need to feel good about your own relationship to church and God, and if you feel you're not out of integrity, then I think that works. So that might be evasive, but I don't think so. I hope not. You're wonderful. I love your faces, and thank you for being here, really.
I'd like to make a comment, too, on this varying religions and everything. I was taught in religion classes in college at BYU, and then I clearly remember President Hinckley saying recently that the church embraces all truth, no matter where it comes from, and that there is much truth in other religions. So I don't think that the church, I think that there are people in the church, of course, who are very closed, but I believe that the doctrines of the church are not closed. Do we have any other questions or comments?
Just had a comment. I would probably consider you a good LDS, just with things which are unusual. I wondered about myself. Am I good LDS if I'm have a touch of Methodism and a touch of Reformed Judaism, and a little bit of Catholicism mixed in with it? Can you consider yourself faithful? A good LDS, in the sense that you adhere to the basic principles, regardless of activity.
Yeah, well, whatever you call the basic principles, I would say that the basic principles to me are having a good heart and being compassionate and loving and caring, and that's to me where the bottom line is. I don't do absolutely every deed that I'm supposed to do. No,
those are general principles, of course, of every religion. So,
Buddha said that we're all in little boats going across the water, and we're all going to the same place. So, I appreciate the wisdom of that. So, we need to be done.
No.
Oh, I thought we heard it.
Well, Phyllis, I would like to ask you whether you concur with me. I would contend that there's something not altogether wholesome, full, rich, and healthy about ascribing to someone else the chore and the ability to measure who you are and give you their stamp of approval. I think that's terribly timid. I mean, if you don't think you're good enough, why should someone else be in charge of making that definition? I think that's not wholesome to give someone else that chore. And I wonder if you agree with me. I mean, that's not fair, but I guess I think I know that you do, and so I dare to say that.
Well, and I just say, in my experience, I think it's very immature to want somebody else to say you're okay, to say you're doing right. I do think that's a process of, I mean, when we grow into our own maturity, we can finally say, yes, I accept the fact, I mean, that God loves me and that we are one. And I really, I think I've come to that place after long, long years of incredible self-effacement and, you know, looking around all the time, you know, oh, I want to look like that, or I want to be like this, or, and I think that's a really a robbery, a theft of our gifts. I think we need to be very happy with who we are. And I finally, and this will sound very, you won't believe me, but I've been a concert pianist and I've written for a lot of years, and I've been very apologetic about my talent. And like, oh, I can't do this, I'm not very good, and all this sort of stuff. And I finally decided that's just a big crock, you know? I mean, we've been given gifts that we need to share. The time is short. You know, we shouldn't sit around, you know, waiting for somebody else to give us their approval. And I'm not suggesting you do anything outrageous, but to quietly know who you are. And you're the only one who knows that, and you're the only one who knows your gifts. And it's time to give them back.
Your comment reminded me of that wonderful line from Porgy and Bess, "Ah, suits me."
Thank you. I like being compared to that.
So, Phyllis, what I want to know is, I think, would you agree with me that you've, since probably really very, very young, you've been a spiritual seeker, because you've been open to looking around and seeing what's happening with you and other people, and you are on a spiritual journey still, are you not? So finding, at this point in your life, what appears to be your new and everlasting love, how has this affected your spiritual journey?
Oh, Paul. How is this a fit? Oh, Paul, that's not fair. Paul's my good friend. Oh, I'm I don't know how to answer that. Well, I will say that I feel like that my life up to this point, before I met this wonderful man, has been a real process, and I feel like that the healing that was given me by Alberto was one of the most remarkable things that ever happened to me, and I didn't tell you that in the paper, but after the healing, I felt this incredible burden truly lived, and of depression and guilt and whatever, I was able to be open and glad to be alive again. And so when I met my fiancé at the knee doctor's, we were both having knee surgery, so then I was really open to, I felt like the gift of the divine had been given to me, and I was ready to live again. So that's how it's affected me, because I was open to receiving love from someone who can give it to me. So.
If you think about you as, say, a lush, fragrant rose, and the members of your church as oak trees, both beautiful organisms, but different. Do you ever think about returning to church, to your ward, to Relief Society meetings, just to be a rose among the oak trees, and sort of as a missionary to spread your passion and your spirituality?
I was living in Minnesota for a while, and I was going to church there, and I've gone a few times in Park City, but I've been traveling so much. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go saying, "Here I am, there's the big rose here." Just take a little sniff here. But, I love it, and it's just not fitting into my life right now, which is not a good answer, but the man I'm marrying is Jewish, and, I consider going back from time to time. Yeah, to be there and to be in a, it's like I said, Chaco said, we need to be there and share who we are with people and not keep thinking we have to all fit into this particular form. So.
Any more last questions? We have a few minutes left.
please forgive me, because this isn't a question too, but I want to say that when we fall into that mode, this is the way it appears to me. I don't know. I don't mean I'm saying this is how it is. This is how I see it. That when you have to have a label, it has to be that label, and it has to be differentiated from those other labels who seem to be contending labels. Again, you've boxed yourself in, leaving out everything except some one something. It isn't fair to expect some one something to be sufficient. Why should it be? The world is a big place. You don't have to. Can it be right that some one thing is it? I don't think so.
Well, it may be it, but there may be an enlarged it behind it, you know? So I just think that the thing that has come to me is just to be open, really open, and not think we know. Because, and I'll tell you what happens in the Tai Chi class, because it's really informative. Here's like the move you make. You go, you know, and it goes on. But for the longest time, I was going like this, you know, doing the move. And then after I watched, and finally the teacher said, I watched her move from here. She's totally moving. The movement comes from here. So all I'm saying is we might think we know, but we really might not have seen. So these are human eyes and human ears and everything. So we need to really say, did I really see? Do I really understand? Read the scripture again. I mean, you know, if you read a scripture when you're 15 and you read it when you're 52, you go, oh. You know, I mean, it's different. Every time you go back to the scriptures, at least for me, they have something new to say. So I think just being open is it's not an outrageous thing to do. It's just to be, do I really know what God is? Do I really know what I believe? So I would just say that's the way to go. And you don't have to condemn anybody. You don't have to do anything. Just say open. Even when somebody says something that you don't like, you can say, did I really hear what you said? It's just a matter of being patient and remaining with that thing until you do know it at a deep level. And I think when we know, our whole bodies know, you know. So.
Phyllis, I was just wondering if in your period where you were getting away from the church, if you went through any anger stage towards the church, organized religion, any, you know, an anger period in that, and if you did, how you dealt with that?
Well, when the one woman, Diane, got up and talked about her son, I had a hemophiliac son who died when he was 3, and that was my first... that's the first time I felt my innocence went away from me, because I thought I knew everything up until then, and that really... It stopped me in my tracks, and I had to really think about that. And I was angry. There was some anger about that. And I had anger about the church for about 10 minutes when I left it. And I'm serious about that. And maybe I wrote one article that was kind of angry or something like that. And then I thought, that's not really how I feel. You know, I'm not angry at the church. I'm very disappointed it didn't work out in the way I had wanted it to, but most of my anger was coming from what I had expected of it, not what it was. And just like a marriage, you know, you expect certain things from a marriage, and when it doesn't match, then you're really ticked off about that. But it's partly to do with what you've set up for yourself. So, but when I wrote a memoir about growing up Mormon in Las Vegas, I have had critics or reviewers say how compassionate they think the book is, and that really pleased me, because I feel that way. I love the culture and I love the people, and I'm one of those people. So my anger wasn't long, and maybe it's because I'm not happy with anger, and maybe because I feel like it's a big burden in myself, and so that's why I don't carry it. I'm lazy. It's the truth. So...
Okay, any others? Okay, well, thank you all for coming today, and thank you, Phyllis, for your paper and your comments. It was very good, very enjoyable. She has a way with words, doesn't she? Words dance for her. Yes. Thank you again for coming.